You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
At the dedication of the George W. Bush Presidential Library in April 2013, President Obama referred to these United States. And the historian Shelby Foote once noted that the U.S. was treated more as a group of separate states until the Civil War. But the Civil War wasn't alone in uniting the states. In his latest book, Simon Winchester looks at the many people whose efforts, often unintentionally, made the U.S. one nation. The men who united the states, America's explorers, inventors, eccentrics, and mavericks, and the creation of one nation indivisible, is published by HarperCollins. I'm very pleased that it's brought Simon Winchester back to our show today. Hello.
Hello.
Hadn't the Revolutionary War and the ratification of the Constitution been uniting forces? How divided were the people of the newly formed United States?
Oh, as we've seen from John Adams, if we remember that television show, all sorts of divisions were running through the country in the very early days. It wasn't really, I think, until Jefferson's presidency and when he decided once the continent was clearly going to be expanded by virtue of the Louisiana Purchase, that there was a real feeling that the 13 somewhat tenuously united former colonies should span the continent and thereby perhaps achieve unity. So I think until 1802, 1803, it was a bit of a ragtag organization, but everything changed with Lewis and Clark.
Well, the founding fathers were often suspicious of each other, and that's why we wind up with the House of Representatives and the Senate. Also, it led to the Three-Fifths Compromise, allowing slaves to be counted for representatives, even though they were denied rights. Did most Americans at that time recognize that significant divisions remained?
Oh, I think absolutely they did, yes. I think there's no question about it.
How much is the history of uniting the states an intentional one as opposed to a kind of natural outcome of other efforts?
I think it's a bit like the British Empire, ironically, that it sort of accreted almost accidentally until the pioneers, I think, started crossing the country. And at that moment, I think this unintentional unification, very few people were making speeches saying in 1830, that this nation needs to be united. But once there were sizable numbers of people settled in California and Oregon and the Dakotas and so forth, then I think a real effort took off, and the whole notion of the Manifest Destiny and so on and so forth, that then unity became the watchword, yes.
So it begins with the Louisiana Purchase.
I think so, yes.
And then acquisition, I don't know what word to use, of large territories from Mexico.
Indeed, and the Gadsden Purchase and, what brought
the
California,
Oregon
New
Treaty.
Spain, the Oregon Treaty, and the final little piece of North Dakota that was finally wrested from, well, I don't think wrested is quite the word, from Canada, from British control. So once all those pieces of the jigsaw were finally put into place in, 1849, then, and that coincided with something that's particularly dear to my heart, the big four geological expeditions, which were organized essentially by President Lincoln, who one might have thought had other things on his mind at the time, to see what this new country was made of. I mean, Lewis and Clark established where it was and what its borders were and where the Sierra were and where the Rockies were, but to find out what it was made of, which strikes me as always tremendously important with any country that's bent on unity, then off went the geologists.
Do you think that Lewis and Clark thought of themselves as participating in an effort to unite the country?
No, I really don't. I think it goes back to your original question that back in those days, there was very little feeling of unity.
They're just going off on an adventure to map things.
Yes, they were going off on. They knew it was very important. They knew they also had to deal with the Native Americans they were likely to find along the way, which is why Jefferson supplied them with so many letters and medals and trinkets, reminding them that they belonged to a country of whom the supreme leader was Jefferson, the president in Washington. So to that extent, Lewis and Clark went off with the mission to remind those who already lived in America that they came under the authority of Washington.
Interestingly, you use the five Chinese elements, wood, earth, water, fire, and metal, to frame your book. Was that just a writer's conceit?
Well, not really. I mean, I'd assembled this enormous list of, once I'd come up with the notion that I'd like to explore the question of unity, and had come up with a list of the people who I thought mechanically or physically had put in place the links or the ideas that sustained or created and then sustained this unity, it was a question of how do you organize it? I mean, you could organize it alphabetically, which would be incredibly tedious. You could organize it possibly chronologically, which might be less tedious, but it would still have a sort of encyclopedic feel to it. And then I was writing a letter to a chum of mine in Shanghai, and I had lived in China for quite a long time. And in the correspondence about something completely non-relevant came this idea of the five classical elements of almost every Eastern society, wood, earth, water, fire, and metal. And it was a sort of an epiphany. I thought maybe this might work. And I did some sort of back-of-the-envelope thoughts that Lewis and Clark had worked quite neatly under the rubric of wood and the geologists under the rubric of earth and so on for the remaining three. And I put it to my editor, I remember, at a lunch here in New York, and he was initially alarmed because the thought of looking at America through the prism, if you like, of Chinese cultural background was risky, to say the least.
But this is not the first time you've thought along these lines. You did Earth with the map that changed the world, water with Atlantic, fire with Krakatoa.
I hadn't thought of that. You're quite right.
I guess wind is next.
Air is one of them. Yes, I haven't quite tackled air. Oddly enough, you mentioned very kindly the map that changed the world. That was about a map published in 1815 after a heroic struggle by a man called William Smith. When I was doing the research for this book, this new book, it turned out that the very first geological map of the world, or in the world, was not the William Smith map of 1815, but a map done by a man called William McClure, here of the Appalachians, published in 1809. So my editor in London, or publisher in London, was saying perhaps we should retitle your book The Second Map That Changed the World.
But your own training is in geology. You argued that geology played a role in uniting the United States because McClure was a geologist and a cartographer?
Well, he was and he wasn't. I mean, this sort of slightly insulting to geologists. This was an extremely rich export-import agent who made a great deal of money, settled down in Philadelphia and thought, I think I'll take up science. I mean, I'm a man of leisure, ease and money now. The easiest of all sciences to acquire is geology. It does very little in nomenclature. It's something that anyone could pick up. And when I mention this to geologists today, they say, this is complete nonsense. I mean, geology is terribly difficult, and how dare he? But he was tremendously important. And indeed, he went down to this little place in a completely overlooked and forgotten town in Indiana called New Harmony and taught geologists. So the first generation of people who surveyed Massachusetts, Connecticut, Illinois, Indiana, Minnesota, all were trained by McClure in Indiana.
This amateur map maker.
This amateur map maker and former export-import man.
My guess is Simon Winchester's latest book is The Men Who United the States. Marguerite Holloway was a guest on our show several months ago to discuss the mapping of Manhattan. Was there a passion for mapping and surveying in the early 1800s?
There really was. And we've got to remember that, of course, West Point is an institution in the army that only relatively recently has been devoted to the vulgar prosecution of war and fighting. It was set up as an engineering, topographic engineering and surveying college. And the elite of the army were surveyors. And I think one of the places that is so little known about in this country and which ought to be is the mark in a place called East Liverpool, Ohio. There's an obelisk standing on the, I think it's Route 39, leading across the Ohio River back into Pennsylvania. Beside it, in a sort of miserable lay-by with litter and graffiti, and is this obelisk. And that obelisk was built there, or at least the original one, on the orders of Thomas Jefferson, the Land Ordinance of 1785, which said that Americans ought to be allowed to own land. I mean, this was a revolutionary idea that Britons, previously it was the king and the aristocracy and the church that owned land, and ordinary people would merely be tenants. But now Jefferson came up with this idea, the Congress approved it, so the land was to be owned.
So this is a revolutionary idea? It didn't occur anywhere else in the world?
Certainly not in countries that were run by the British crown, which was a very large chunk of the world. I'm not certain whether in Russia. I doubt it. I imagine
well,
that was
France, post-revolutionary,
France,
maybe.
Once again, post-revolutionary, but pre-revolutionary, no. I mean, this is a time of great social ferment in the world. And so it was a man called Thomas Hutchins was appointed to organize a system of surveys, which we now enjoy today, the townships and the ranges and all those squares you see looking down from the aeroplane. But where did they begin? They began at this obelisk in East Liverpool, which is covered with rubbish today. It should, in my view, have, you know, parking lots and school buses should turn up there. Everyone should see it.
Like the Four Corners. Which
slightly more important than the Four Corners. Yeah. And yet, oddly enough, the Four Corners derive their origin from East Liverpool, Ohio. So you're exactly right.
Had a territory of the size of the United States been mapped before the early 1800s? Had the Chinese ever attempted to map?
No, I mean,
Russians? Because this is the largest land mass other than those two on Earth at that time.
Well, they simply hadn't. I mean, there was this big effort. This could be an immensely long digression, but there was this attempt in 1870 to create a map of the entire world at the scale of 1 to 1 million. And they made, it would take 1,800 sheets, another large number of sheets of the seas. There's no point in mapping that. But they finally gave it up, having produced about 900 in 1985. But up to that point, there were no maps of Central Russia, certainly no maps of Western China.
Your title suggests that all of the key figures in the story were men. Where are women in the story?
Well, I'm taking some stick for this, as one imagines. So there was I think it's a very good thing to do to look at one-star reviews you get in Amazon.com, and I've got one from day one from a lady who said, I'm simply going to say I'm a militant feminist and I'm not even going to pick up your book because how dare you say the men who united the states. But in the story of the physical uniting of the states, I'm not talking about ideas that knitted the country together, but physical ideas, there really is only one, and that's Sacagawea, the Shoshone companion of Lewis and Clark, met in Fort Mandan in the Dakotas.
None of the suffragists?
Well, that's the point. I mean, that, with respect, is ideas which I was trying to steer away from. I mean, someone said, what about Harriet Beecher Stowe? She's an obvious candidate. Well, yes, but if I were writing a book about the ideas that united the states, of course they'd get equal attention, but there simply were no women involved in this story.
Many of the men that you write about were immigrants to the United States, most of them coming from Europe. Could it be that Europe's experiment in unification was set in North America?
You mean contemporary European?
Yes.
Well, yes. If so, not a great success, quite honestly. I mean, and that's one of the odd things when I was sort of preparing the book. I thought of the large entities around the world. Most are not united. I mean, Canada, wonderful country, but with a great Francophone chunk in the middle, which always threatens to split it into three. Russia, since the Soviet Union's collapse, a huge sort of gallimaufry of other countries. And Europe, well, I mean, I was English until I took American citizenship. We don't use the euro still. We sort of pout and say, no, we don't want it.
The Greeks are angry with the Germans. The Germans are angry with the Greeks.
You try and plug your shaver into Stockholm, you'll need a different thing than in Madrid. So it's all a bit of a mishmash still. But America, whether you're in Maine or Oregon, whether you're a Sephardic Jew or an Algonquian Indian or a Latina in Albuquerque, you're all the same.
For much of U.S. history, Native Americans and Africans abducted and enslaved here were forcibly excluded from the story of unity. How much of the uniting of the states depended on the suffering of others?
Oh, I think a great deal. There's no doubt about that. And I go into the Indian, Native American question reasonably extensively, yes. I mean, a great deal of the, as it were, the construction, the unification, was bought with the blood of and the suffering of those two groups of people. There's no doubt about it at all. And it goes back to the very beginning. I mean, when we're talking about Jefferson and the land ordinance and people should be able to own land, but who owned it before? And to disregard the fact that, you know, the Cheyenne or the Navajo or the Sioux at least had some prescriptive right, you would have thought, to the land, we ignore that. But then you get into the whole philosophical argument, you know, all property is theft and so forth. You've got to begin the argument somewhere. And sadly, it begins with a lot of suffering.
In this case, theft was theft of property.
Theft, you're quite right, exactly.
Simon Winchester's latest book, the follow-up to his bestsellers Atlantic and The Professor and The Madman and others, is the men who united the states, America's explorers, inventors, eccentrics, and mavericks, and the creation of one nation indivisible. It is published by Harper, and we will continue our conversation after this. We're back with Simon Winchester, who is the author of many books, including The Professor and the Madman, Atlantic, The Men Who Loved China, A Crack in the Edge of the World, and Krakatoa, all of which were New York Times bestsellers. His most recent is The Men Who United the States, America's Explorers, Inventors, Eccentrics, and Mavericks, and the Creation of One Nation Indivisible. It is published by Harper. And most of these people were also self-taught. We mentioned McClure, who was a self-taught geologist and mapmaker, but you go down the list and you see so many of these people were self-invented, which I guess was part of the appeal of the United States for immigrants.
I suppose one of the classics is Samuel Morse, really. I mean, Morse, and I've always thought that patent 1647, which is the patent for the telegraph and the Morse code.
He's a painter.
Well, that's the point. And he was a painter, not terribly successful, it has to be said. And he, the date that is relevant to this story, had just been turned down for the commission to paint the inside of the rotunda of the Capitol, and went off very disgruntled with the hope of painting Marquis Lafayette in Paris. And I think that didn't go too well either. And finally, thinking himself a completely washed up, forlorn failure of a human being, came back on the ship from Le Havre to New York, and while on the ship, met an electrical engineer, and the two of them were chatting, and he, Morse, at school, had gained some knowledge of electricity and such, you know, very primitive, of course, in those days, and had this idea, and there's still some argument to this day about who actually had the idea of sending, as it were, sparks that could be rendered into dots and dashes by way of a device that we now know as a telegraph. But he got off the boat and immediately set to work, not as a painter, but furiously, and it took him many years, in rooms near where NYU is now, to create the first ever Morse telegraph. And, of course, the rest is then history.
Well, Morse is one of a broad range of men and projects you have in this book, Lewis and Clark. We mentioned mapping, the building and paving of roads. It's a long list, but plenty of countries have built roads and technologies. What makes the United States different?
Well, I suppose the scale is one thing, but also, I mean, they were first in many of these efforts. I mean, after all, if we're sticking it with roads, there is no road system in the world as comprehensive, as expensive, and enabling such astonishingly long distances of high-speed, uninterrupted travel to be accomplished.
Well, the Romans had done it earlier. And weren't the British doing it in some of their colonies?
Not to the extent that, Canada, I mean, dear, wonderful Canada, has got one long road, the Trans-Canada Highway from Halifax to Vancouver. But the network in America is just extraordinary. It's the envy of all. I mean, as it is said, is it not, that Eisenhower had the idea for it when he saw the autobahns in Germany at the end of World War II. That turns out not to be true. He actually got the idea in 1919, when in a very deliberate act of unification, and a lot of these things did come from military men, soldiers in 1919, the generals, worried that the Japanese, although they simply called them an Asiatic nation, might be having their eyes on California, just put in the theoretical question, how rapidly can we get a lot of soldiers from the bases in the East Coast out to the West in case the Japanese landed?
But even before then, when was the American network of roads first conceived?
Well, I mean, there were a lot of fairly good roads, I mean, by colonial standards, built right at the very beginning. I mean, Jefferson once again, and Washington too, the big road builders, there was the National Road, which went from Washington, D.C. to Cumberland, Maryland, and then over through that little odd bit of Maryland where the Youghiogheny River begins and goes off to the Gulf and ends up in Ohio. So there was a road. I mean, it was an appalling road, but then came MacAdam, who taught everyone from Scotland how to make stone road surfaces compact, and so a macadamized road, not a tar macadamized road like today, but the idea of putting little stones which were as could be accommodated in your mouth, and you got these little people chipping stones and putting them in their mouths, and when they could fit, they put them in a pile, and those were the ones that we used to spread on the road, compacted by the passing vehicles. They were wonderfully comfortable roads to ride on, but very dusty.
So they required a little saliva along with
the
other thing.
A great deal of saliva in and the making of the United States. Yes.
The railroads were the ultimate uniters.
Yes, and my big hero in this story is this somewhat forgotten, at least he's remembered in California, but I think in the East, Theodore Judah is very little remembered, a preacher's son from Connecticut, I think, who was the one who was absolutely determined that should be a transcontinental railway, and identified after a great deal of heartache and walking in through the Sierra Nevada, that the place through which the railway should be punched was the Donner Pass, and of course the that is where the Union Pacific lines go to this day. And I, you know, many's the time one goes through and see these trains sort of effortlessly thundering over the ridge that your poor old car is laboring up. It was a stroke of engineering genius.
You seem to focus largely on infrastructure and technology, canals, roads, railroads, electricity, telegraph, telephone, television. Technology is a crucial factor in economic growth. Is growth itself a unifying force?
I think it has to be, because it produces a feeling of common wealth, if you like. Yes, I think growth is hugely important. And when people like Herbert Hoover, a good example, when Secretary of Commerce, when radio was beginning, said that radio should in this country be, and this was a big departure from Lord Reith at the BBC, radio should be promoting the growth of our nation commercially, which is why from the get-go, the nation favoured the idea of there being advertising on radio. And it took a very long time for there to be a united a network of radio stations that did not take advertising as we have today. I mean, it's astonishing, is it not, that if radio was invented, or the first voice radio was 1906, then for national public radio to be created by these people like Bill Seymering, it took until the late 1960s and 70s.
The process is totally opposite in most parts of the world. Most countries start off with national broadcasters and then wound up allowing for commercial broadcasting. We had commercial broadcasting. And by the way, WNYC was owned by the city of New York. It had no advertising in 1928. So there were little exceptions, but they were definitely the exceptions.
Well, sure. I mean, but they weren't in a network. I mean, that was the point, yeah. That there were educational stations and city-owned municipal stations. I mean, WHA, the first station in the country in Madison, Wisconsin, I think was commercial-free. But nonetheless, the preponderance of radio stations in this country was seen as devices for printing money.
Monetary union was supposed to unify Europe, but it's turned out to be a rocky consolidation. Economists would note that the United States has a unified fiscal system that the EU does not. Is there one thing, like central or federal government, that does the lion's share of unifying the United States, or any nation for that matter?
Well, I suppose central banks always do, don't they? They set the monetary policy of the nation, and I would have thought the Fed is a economically unifying entity.
There are politicians in this country who'd like to get rid of the
Fed
now. Well, are we moving backward?
Well,
de-unifying,
I think we're moving backwards in other areas. I don't think I would like to get into the deep waters of talking about monetary union, but technology, I think, is actually doing a disservice to union at the moment, and has started to do so ever since the invention of cable television, that we're being now divided into hundreds and thousands of little special interest groups. Whereas, I mean, the image in the 1930s of the family gathered around the walnut veneered radio set in the living room, mother, father, children, dog, cat, listening to a distant broadcast from the NBC orchestra under Toscanini in New York, or a comedy show beamed in from Los Angeles, sort of illustrates both national cultural unity and domestic unity. But now, you know, the father is in the den watching ESPN and mother is watching a cooking program or something, and the children are texting or watching things on their computers. everything has changed and everything has become more disunited.
Well, when cable was first started, people talked about how wonderful it is that we could do narrow casting instead of having one size fits all. You're saying that the one size fits all sometimes may have led to stupid programs, but at least it was they were unifying?
Well, yes and no. I mean, I can see that you might say that this dumbs down the national culture.
Remember when the head of the FCC talked about...
Newt Minow.
Yes.
Talking about this, the nation was awash in cultural nonsense. Yes, I mean, there's no doubt that that was a consequence of it, which is why, to go back to NPR, how laudable the effort to elevate the national discourse, but make it a national discourse. But I think one of the problems, and I believe you me, I'm an abiding fan, as I know you are, of public radio, but the original idea was that 30% of the output of national public radio, at least All Things Considered, which was the first really national program, should come from the country itself, from the stations. But that idea and the person who advanced it, Bill Siemering, were both relegated pretty swiftly. And most of NPR's news output certainly comes nowadays from Washington, which I regret.
And Los Angeles.
Well, and to a smaller extent, yes, yes.
My guest is Simon Winchester, whose latest book is The Men Who United the States, America's Explorers, Inventors, Eccentrics, and Mavericks, and the Creation of One Nation Indivisible. The people in your book represent American history since 1800. Do you see the process as continuing today, despite what we were just talking about?
I think I don't, actually, sadly. I mean, what we were talking about, the extent to which the internet and cable TV and so forth are dividing us up on a sort of somewhat micro level. On a macro level, I have to say I maybe this is just a reflection of what's been happening politically in the past few days. I do wonder about Texas, I have to say. I mean, it would be...
Well, it has talked about seceding.
Well, that's what I mean.
But
I mean,
secession didn't work the last time.
It certainly didn't. Whenever I stay in London, I stay in a place that compels me to walk past the little street where the blue plaque is on a wall which says, here stood the Embassy of the Republic of Texas. And it sort of sends a reminder that all the kind of commentary that's coming from Texas at the moment makes one wonder how secure is the United States that we've known for so long.
It's interesting that a number of the people who you're referring to also talk a lot about American exceptionalism. Would you say that that this book is, in a way, advancing a version of American exceptionalism?
Well, yes, I think it is. I mean, I read a lot about Frederick Jackson Turner and the whole concept of the frontier and how Americans who had gone through the frontier experience uniquely among most nations were different from other people in that they were sort of more bombastic, more enthusiastic, more energetic, more liable to shoot than to argue, more like, you know, that the Turner thesis was shot down fairly swiftly after it was advanced in the early part of the last century. Part of it lingers still in this argument that America is an exceptional people.
With a sense of manifest destiny, as you mentioned.
With a sense of manifest destiny. And, I mean, I thought one of the interesting things when I was in Missouri following the early part of the Lewis and Clark story was the existence there of Whiteman Air Force Base, which I had been to in the 1970s when it was a Minuteman base. Now it's a B-2 stealth bomber base. And while I was there, they sent off two bombers to frighten the North Koreans during that time when Kim Jong-un was behaving badly 6 months ago.
And oh, it could be any day.
Well, it could be. I know. They were going to send them to Syria. And it just makes me wonder, I think people should ask the question more often, why does America arrogate to itself this belief that it has any business at all in sending planes to frighten people in North Korea or Syria?
And people have questioned whether we should be the policemen of the world.
Well, precisely. And it was things that Lewis and Clark said in their diaries and the way that they treated the Indians in one or two of the encounters in the Dakota that made me think that this attitude, this slightly, and believe you me, I'm an American now, so I'm part of the problem, but this sort of bombastic let's rule the world or police the world, all began a long, long time ago.
On the other hand, less than 60 years after Lewis and Clark, the country was breaking apart with the Civil War. Were there forces like slavery that were serving to drive the country apart at the same time that others were working to unify it?
Were there forces in this country other than slavery?
Well, it seems so contradictory. At the same time that we see all sorts of things happening that are unifying the country, we are splitting apart and fighting a really awful war.
I agree, and obviously this is a part of the story that I only go into in passing because it does interrupt the progress of unification. But what is left behind still is a legacy of relatively poor communications across the South. The legacy, because at this time in the 1860s, when unification was getting into high gear, when all, for instance, to go back to my pet subject, the geological surveys of the country were being undertaken, none of them were undertaken in the southeast of the United States because of that very reason. There was fighting. The railroad service in the southeast United States is lamentable compared to the east, west, and northwest and southwest corners. So the southeast suffers monumentally from this.
And even now, governors of both of the southeastern states reject the idea of high-speed rail. So that's... And that's actually indicative of another kind of polarization that we're seeing in this country. A lot of the people we've been talking about are well-known, but I'd never heard of the Chicago Sanitary District Canal. What is that, and how does it play a role in unifying the country?
Hugely important insofar as it linked the Great Lakes to the Mississippi River. I mean, the river system that
Had the Erie Canal been there before?
No, the Erie Canal links the Great Lakes to the Atlantic Ocean, yeah, to New York. The Erie Canal was the first. I mean, in the order of the great canals in America, the Middlesex Canal, which essentially allowed Boston to become a port with a huge hinterland. The Erie Canal, which allowed New York the same thing, but much longer, greater hinterland, was that canal went all the way from Albany to Buffalo. Then there was the question of, well, how do we get the trade goods from Lake Superior and Illinois to the Gulf? And that required the building, first of all, of a little canal, the Illinois and Michigan, but then the realization of two things that were needed. One, very unsavory, which is that Chicago's sewage all flowed into the lake, and on a hot summer day, this was not a pleasant place to be. So the city fathers saw to it that, well, let's erase this 200-foot hill that's sort of in the middle of Chicago, cut a canal through it and send all the rubbish to the west where people don't care so much, but at the same time make this canal big enough that we can drive dirty great ships through it and then link those with the Des Plaines River and down to the Illinois River and into the Mississippi. And that worked for quite a long time.
You talked about things like cable television disuniting us, perhaps computers as well, the Internet. But today, China is expanding its high-speed rail system at a breakneck pace. The U.S. rail system is declining. I think we can all agree to that. Does that suggest to you that America's uniqueness might not last?
Well, I must say I worry about it. I did a long piece on the China high-speed rail system for Vanity Fair recently, and I go to China a great deal. I mean, I recently traveled along the Silk Road when it was being repaved and found that this is indicative of how brilliant the Chinese are in their infrastructure, that they had already, before the road was built, had built a system of telephone towers. I could use Google when I had an accident in the Gobi Desert on what soon was going to be the new high-speed Silk Road. I could look up Google, find a hotel 250 miles away, and they sent people across the desert to pick me up and rescue me. I mean, quite extraordinary, the speed and the speed of the technological development of China. Somehow America's got to get, I mean, they're getting it in California, the idea that high-speed rail is essential. People have got to be told in
now,
the East.
Some people would see Obamacare as an attempt to unify the country under one health care system. But there's been incredible resistance. You think that we are entering another psychological phase here?
It just astonishes me. I'm sorry, I'm a European, and you know every European country has a decent, workable health care system, as has Canada to our north, as Japan, where my wife comes from. It astonishes me, the resistance to, well, to big government. There are certain things that the government, I think, should be involved in. I mean, you mentioned rural electrification a few moments ago. I mean, it is essential. It was essential in the 1930s that the farms were connected electrically. I mean, it was monstrous that they shouldn't have been. But it took the government to do it. And it is an irony, I think, that the first district in America to get rural electrification, which is in Western Ohio, is the constituency now represented by John Boehner.
And the TVA right now is under attack, as we discussed recently on a segment on this show. Simon Winchester's latest book is The Men Who United the States, America's Explorers, Inventors, Eccentrics, and Mavericks, and the Creation of Our One Nation Indivisible. It is published by Harper. Thank you so much for being with us again.
Thank you very much indeed.